Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices. Hey everyone, thanks for joining us. We are talking about a subject today that I really don't know a lot about, so I am really interested to get started. We are going to be talking to Ruby Davis, and she is the wildlife biologist and wildlife rehabilitation director of the Carolina Wildlife Conservation Center in North Carolina. So Ruby, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always excited to talk about skunks.
I heard you on another podcast, yeah. And I was so excited. You were also talking about skunks, but it was at a higher level because it wasn't for wildlife rehabilitators. And I need to have you on this podcast because everybody needs to hear a lot more about skunks. Yeah. So could you, for our listeners, tell everybody a little bit of your origin story?
Okay, for me personally, I actually became a rehabber probably about 15 plus years ago. And I have to admit, I was one of those guilty people that had an outdoor cat and that would bring me victims. And so I felt like I was responsible for taking care of those patients. So I did. I took the basic rehab class and got my license. But it's funny how things fall into place, because then that led me to getting my wildlife biology degree and becoming a wildlife biologist. And I worked for a stream and wetland restoration company for several years. So all of that now is coming into play for my current job, which is great. So yeah, that's how this all started for me and what it turned into.
Wow. You know, it's amazing how you can bring everything forward to assist, especially with, you know, being a wildlife biologist. I'm also graduated with a biology degree. I can't call myself a wildlife biologist, but I really think also that that has helped me in my rehabilitation. I draw from it all the time. So I think it is just help. So how long have you been with the Carolina Wildlife Conservation Center?
So I've been with them now since the beginning, since we opened up, which is 5 years now.
Wow. Excellent.
Yeah. This area was needing it for several years, but having it now and it's come to fruition, it's amazing to be able to rehab in a center and not out of my house.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yes. A lot.
Yeah. Well, I may talk to you again about starting a center and all the details and the headaches and the joys and everything of starting a center, because that is no small endeavor.
It's not, but I'll be happy to share any information I can with you to help you.
Awesome. Awesome. Because there's a lot of folks out there struggling, trying to figure out the path, the path that they should take in this. Yeah. And there's many paths. So today, of course, we're going to talk about skunks. Yeah. Now, I on purpose didn't say the type of skunk, but we'll get into that, what is more common and all that type of thing. But, and maybe we should do that right now, is because I do want to talk about natural history, because a lot of people have heard me say that I think rehabilitation, you can find almost all your answers in the natural history of the animal for rehabilitation. And I do really believe that. And so that's why we always start out talking about natural history. So if we were going to talk about natural history, let's talk about striped skunks, since they tend to be fairly common. Yes. And I don't know if there's any differences with any of the other skunk species.
There are, for sure. But I will say, here in North Carolina, we have two species, which is the spotted and the striped. However, the striped is the most common for us, and actually the only species that we've had intakes on, because the spotted for us are in higher elevations, the mountain regions, and I'm more of the foothill Piedmont area. So we only receive the striped skunk right now. And so that's what we encounter quite often. But like all the other skunks, they are omnivores. You know, they have a very wide range, diverse diet. You know, it's consisting from anything from small rodents to small reptiles. A lot of people don't realize that they're immune to venom. So they will actually eat copperheads and other venomous snakes.
Okay, wait, I did not know that.
Yeah, most people don't. They think of the possum when it comes to that, but skunks are the same way, you know, and the badgers, which is, you know, in that same family or order or whatever. But it's applicable to them as well. So that's good, you know, to share that information with people, I think.
I think so, too.
Yeah. Wow, but their diet is so diverse, you know, like anything from carrion, they'll take advantage of that, but bird eggs, fruits, orchards, that's, you know, fruit from orchard trees that's fallen, apples or cherries or pears, vegetables in your garden, they'll take advantage of that. But there's a whole array of things that they'll eat, you know, and that applies to all of them. But I will say that one of the things that they love, and once people learn this about skunks, they seem to have a little bit more appreciation of them if they didn't have any at all, is the fact that they love yellow jackets. And they will actually dig up the yellow jacket nest out of your yard and devour them. And I've seen it done out of, you know, several nests in my yard. And so I appreciate them for that.
Wow, I didn't know that either. That's something that they seek out, because it certainly seems from the list that you're giving is that these are opportunistic omnivores, right? Yes. Whatever they're encountering, hey, I'm going to try to eat it.
Yeah.
And wow, oh my God. Yeah, I would appreciate them in my yard too.
Once people learn that, they're like, okay, if that's what you're doing. But yeah, they are opportunistic eaters. They mainly go by smell. They have a high olfactory sensory and then auditory. Their vision is not the best. So definitely their nose is working overtime for finding their food.
So what kind of habitats do you find them in?
Well, the thing is for us in the lower elevations, which, you know, applies in the higher's as well, is they love deciduous forest, and they're going to have different canopy levels, and that's protecting them from the aerial predators. You know, your owls are your number one predators for them, natural predators, I should say, because your owls don't smell. So they'll definitely go after a skunk and not worry about being sprayed. Whereas your other mammals, such as your coyotes or foxes, they'll think twice about that. So definitely canopy coverage for them is key. They're always going to be in close to streams or ponds, a water source. So your riparian deciduous forests have those usually. They'll take advantage of rock crops or outcrops and get into crevices of those. They love to have hollow logs to den in. They'll take advantage of groundhog dens or burrows. You know, and groundhog burrows have multiple chambers. And so I've seen actually here that there's a groundhog and a skunk coming out of the same hole. So I know there's multiple chambers in there. They're taking advantage of that. So they'll definitely seek refuge in their forest area. But of course, they'll be in the open fields as well, trying to find their foods. When it comes to where they find their food, they're not picky about that. But when it comes time for refuge, you know, especially during baby season, they will take advantage of people's sheds or decks, you know, getting in their barns. So that's when we get a lot of phone calls. Oh, I've got a skunk around and I want it gone, that kind of stuff. But
right.
actual habitat for us, they're losing because of development. So
yeah.
a lot of the forests are being clear cut and they're losing that. So they are trying to seek refuge and adapt to what's been given to them. Sad,
right.
but that is the case, at least here in North Carolina.
Yeah, habitat is still, you know, climate change, of course, is a huge, huge challenge. And we still don't know how that's going to affect a lot of animals.
Yeah.
But habitat destruction and habitat change is still the number one
Oh, yeah.
challenge.
Yeah.
And boy, humans are really good at making the environment fit ourselves.
Right.
And we change the environment. So if you've got an adaptable species, they probably will adapt. And
yeah.
if you don't have an adaptable species, you might not. So skunks
yeah.
might, at least striped skunks might do okay. You know, if the tolerance level is up there for humans, right? For skunks.
Yeah.
You were talking about owls and aerial predators being a natural predator.
Mm-hmm.
And I work for the Raptor Center, and we do
yeah.
get great horned owls, and especially
smell bad.
You're like, well, I know what you ate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right. They have a very poor sense of smell, so they just don't seem to care.
Yeah.
So are these guys mostly nocturnal? Are they crepuscular?
They are, you know, mainly nocturnal, but, you know, one of the things I want people to understand and we try to educate them about is that you will see them out during the day, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're rabid, you know, especially during the spring and summer when they've got babies. These moms, just like other species, your raccoons and your foxes, they're going to go out during the day while the babies are sleeping and try to find food. So it's not uncommon to see females out during the day during the spring and summer. Now, come winter, you also see both genders out because they want to take advantage of the warmer day, you know, temperatures versus the night temperatures. So just because you see a skunk out during the day doesn't necessarily mean they're rabid, but typically they are nocturnal species, you know, up until dusk hours as well.
Okay.
But, you know, that's the main thing that we get calls about, too, with them and other species. Oh, they're out during the day. They must be rabid. No, that's not necessarily true. Unless they're showing some other symptoms, then we just tell people to use caution, right? And give them space. Don't just go running up on a skunk, because you will encounter the worst part of it, which is being sprayed.
That's right. Oh, my gosh. We're going to talk about that when raising orphans later.
Yeah.
About how to deal with, because they develop that ability very, very early.
They do.
I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So let's talk about still in their natural history, kind of a life cycle. And skunks aren't really quote unquote herd or pack animals. They're more solitary, which is probably a good thing for lots of reasons. Let's talk life cycle.
Okay. Well, you know, we've got the females, which are your does, and your males, which are bucks. And of course, they're going to mate. For us, they'll start mating in January and February. For you guys in Minnesota, I don't know how long or how soon your winter starts, but they're mating during the winter and they're going to have babies in spring and summer.
Okay.
And for the striped skunk, the gestation period, you know, is 65 to 75 days, I believe, and they can have anywhere from 1 to 10 kits. But depending on the availability of food will also dictate how many offspring they have, right? And that's with most of your animals anyways. You know, the average that we see is probably about 5, I think, is the most we've had in a litter, maybe 6, but I haven't had any more than that. But the males do not help with the raising of the babies. Mom's doing it all by herself. So again, she's out trying to find food during the day or whenever she can when the kits are sleeping. Because once they're big enough, which is about 2 months, they're going to be following her around. And so you'll see them together, actually. It's so cute because they'll follow in a single file line or they're like huddle around her, but they move together. You know, once they're up and about and able to be mobile, one of the things I want people to realize is if you see baby skunks without a mom, then they need to come into care because they should not be without a mom at any time.
So it's not, so that part is a little bit different than like a raccoon. You know, if a raccoon mom is moving kits from one place to another, you might be able to leave the kit in a box with a, you know, thing to keep it warm or whatever. And then reuniting, same thing with squirrels.
Yeah.
But if you see a baby skunk on its own, it's orphaned.
We don't reunite with those because 9 times out of 10, you don't even know where their den is, or you don't know, of course, if mom was killed. But by the time people find baby skunks, they're already in bad condition. Usually they are dehydrated for sure. And their fur is very deceiving and can mislead people. Like, oh, it looks healthy. It's nice and fluffy. But like I said, that fur is so deceiving. Unless you're actually familiar with them and putting hands on, 9 times out of 10, people don't realize that they're dehydrated and emaciated. So yeah, if you find an orphaned or even, you know, a litter without a mom, they need to come into care, because mom does not leave her babies like that.
Okay. And that's good to know that, you know, good mom and is not going to abandon at the first sign of problems or anything. So they, since they, you know, like hollow logs, they'll go in outcroppings, they'll go in a lot of other things. Is that where they choose for their den too?
Yes. Yes, they do. You know, if mom feels like it's safe and, you know, they're protected from mainly the predators, they would definitely take advantage of, like I said, the groundhog dens or burrows, vacant fox dens. They'll take advantage of those. You know, the thing about striped skunks is that they're not fearful of, you know, trying to find food wherever, but of course they may encounter dogs. So being underneath sheds and people's backyards can be a risk for them. But normally once they have their babies, they disperse very quickly. Mom decides, okay, it's time for us to leave and let's go find something else to live in. But, you know, by the fall, all the babies have dispersed out. So when people complain about them being underneath their shed for, you know, any length of time, I let them know they're not going to stay there very long. They're nomadic, and they're going to want to find other places to sleep, find foods and that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Okay. So that brings up a good point that they're not like holding a territory or anything like that, that they're pretty nomadic in their, and once they are on their own in the fall from mom, then, I mean, do they still kind of hang out together? Or are they just really just go on their merry way and brothers
usually
and sisters don't hang out with each other or anything?
Typically they go about their merry way, especially the males, because they'll reach sexual maturity usually a little bit earlier than the females. But I do know that in the winter, you can find skunks hanging out together and sharing burrows, right? The more body heat you got, the warmer you're going to stay.
That's right.
And it's usually, you know, going to be probably an offspring of hers. Or, I mean, it could be that there's a couple of skunks that get along and there's enough food that they're not fighting over everything, right? So they can shack up together in the winter for the sole purpose of, you know, conserving heat, keeping each other warm, that kind of stuff. But typically by fall, everybody's dispersed out and they're doing their own thing because mom's going to be mating again. And of course the offspring will be able to start reproducing. Like I said, the males is usually 9 to 12 months. They're actually reaching sexual maturity. The females, it's a little bit longer, but within less than 2 years, all your offsprings are able to reproduce.
Oh, able to reproduce. Okay. In North Carolina, do skunks, and I wouldn't call it a hibernation because they don't truly hibernate here in Minnesota either. But so they are, is it warm enough that they are coming out every night and feeding or?
No, not always. I mean, they don't go into a torpor stage like your bats do. But if it's really cold, like tonight, last night was our first true cold night, I think, like 20 degrees. And I didn't see any skunks out and about. And I'm out in the country and I see them on a regular basis, right? But last night, I didn't see anybody, not just skunks, but I didn't see any animals out.
Including humans, probably. We're staying home.
When it's cold, they don't come out as often. So, you know, during the day, they might come out to try to find some food if they didn't eat that night before. But usually they won't. They'll just wait and see if it warms up. Then they'll come back out again. But they don't stay down very long, put it like that.
Okay. How is their, in general, their metabolism? Because I know weasels and mink and things like that have an incredibly high metabolism. They can't hibernate. They can't go into torpor because they have to eat all the time.
Yeah. Well, the skunks is not, their metabolism is not as high as your weasels or your minks. You know, it's less than that. And if you see, most of the time, your skunks are a little rotund, they're little round things, whereas your weasels and minks are a little bit, are leaner for sure, but they're just so active. They're very fast. Whereas your skunks, if you watch them, they kind of got a little waddle to them. They're not in a hurry for anything. They're taking their time, right?
They're
slowly finding their food, whereas the minks and the weasels, they're on a mission. Like, they're going to find it, and they're going to find it fast, and they're going to take it down because they're aggressive. Whereas your skunks are not aggressive animals, which is great. And I want people to understand that. So, you know, a mink and a weasel will tear your hand up in a heartbeat. And plus, you're not even going to be able to catch them. They're so fast. Whereas a skunk, you can. But my point in that is that their metabolism is not as fast as your mink and your weasels.
Right. Yeah, we talked to Peggy Pop from Wisconsin about orphan weasel and mink care. And yeah, that was so revelatory, you know, as far as like how often you have to feed and all of these kinds of things. So I just am always comparing animals to them.
Yeah, I know. Peggy's great. She was actually my go-to for my mink and weasel when I've got those to rehab. Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, there's something to be said for specialists, boy.
Absolutely.
There really is. So, okay. So we have the does having their kits in the spring. They stay with their mom through the summer and into the fall, and then they kind of disperse.
Right.
So when we'll talk about aging kits in a little bit, but so people are not usually encountering baby skunks when they're in their den, whatever that den might be.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually a couple months in and they are now mobile, correct? So they're coming out and wandering with mom or whatever, and somebody gets separated or mom gets killed or something like that. When you get phone calls on what kinds of circumstances do people talk to you about?
Most people, if they do encounter a litter, I did have a couple of incidents where someone was tearing up their shed. And so they literally lifted up with like a bulldozer or some sort of construction equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And the floor fell down and killed mom, but the babies were there.
So
that has happened. Or just construction itself, you know, digging into the ground with construction equipment. I've had them come into care for that reason too. But 9 times out of 10, people are finding them wandering in their yard aimlessly because they don't have mom. Mom's been hit by a car. A lot of times people find the kits on the road with mom. A lot of times they're deceased as well, and there may be like one or two left. Or, you know, mom was hit and killed, but the baby's still alive if she was transporting one, you know, to another den site or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But usually that's how we get the orphans or actually nests or dens have been flooded out. We've had several come into care because they've been drowning or, you know, flooded out. And that is never good because skunks go have hypothermia really quickly. So it's always key to get them warmed up because we can definitely lose those pretty fast for that purpose or for that reason, actually.
Sure.
But then we encounter adults and have adults on intake for a variety of reasons as well. Like I said, hit by cars if they survive that impact, attacked by dogs. We've encountered that several times. Poor little things get their head stuck in
yogurt containers. Yes.
Yeah, we've had those happen. Incidents where mom was sleeping with the babies underneath a brush pile and they set the brush pile on fire. Rat poison. We've had them come in for rat poison. So there's a whole array. Like I said, you know, the natural predators are the least of their problems. It's the humans that cause more problems for them, it seems, and why we need to care. And of course, there's always sickness. The one thing I would say here in North Carolina is not the rabies that's killing the skunks or even, you know, raccoons for that matter. It's canine distemper. Distemper is really running rampant right now in the state of North Carolina. I don't know about other states. I feel certain it probably is. But that's the main cause of sickness here for our skunks in North Carolina.
Right. Yeah. And raccoons. Yeah. Here in Minnesota, distemper. I'm on a rescue team. And that's all we've been doing this winter is rescuing raccoons. And yeah, it's like, oh, distemper. Yeah, we don't. We have very few raccoons with rabies. Yeah. So anytime we see them not feeling well and they're out and about during the day and curled up underneath a bird feeder, it's like, oh, unfortunately.
Same here.
And and my guess is that if a skunk comes in with distemper, humane euthanasia is generally the choice.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because there's really not much we can do for them.
Yeah.
So I figured it would be the same, but thought I should clarify that. Yeah. Okay. So telephone tips, things that, you know, or things you put out on social media, or because skunks, of course, have a bad rap and people are like, oh, my God, it was sprayed, or they're all rabid or whatever. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things do you tell people or help people with skunks to help them kind of moderate their views?
Yeah. Well, the one thing for us on our hotline is we always ask for a picture. A picture can tell mm-hmm. you a lot. So depending on the condition of what that animal looks like, and like I said earlier, if they're orphaned and by themselves, 9 times out of 10, they need to come into care. But other tips we tell them, especially if they're going to contain them for transport, is always wear gloves, right? And not just your typical latex gloves, but thick gloves, because they will bite. They're either scared or they're hurt, right? Mm-hmm. And so they don't know that you're trying to help them. You know, they're going to look at you as more of a threat. So we want to make sure we're using caution and common sense. And so always to wear gloves, never pick these animals up with bare hands. Other tips that we tell people is if you gently approach them and announce you're coming, they don't usually spray. And we do that when we're releasing with pre-release cages and stuff. And we'll talk about that later. But, you know, approaching slowly and not quickly so you don't look like a big predator coming after them. We tell people to lay a towel over them. You've got your gloves on, but tuck the tail. If you tuck the tail, they're less likely to spray themselves.
Oh, pro tip number one.
Yeah. And they, like I said earlier, they're not aggressive animals. Mm-hmm. They're pretty docile. But if you tuck their tail and you've got their head covered, then you're less likely to be sprayed and you're less likely to be bit. Those are the number one tips that we tell them, of course. You know, and if they've had some sort of injury that's obvious, we tell people not to try to do anything with those. You know, of course, with their if they're babies, number one tips, and this is with all animals, I'm sure you know, is don't mm-hmm. attempt to feed them. Right? Like everybody wants to feed these animals when they get them in. And if they're rushing you into an ER, they're not throwing a steak at you. You know, they're going to administer and deal with your, you know, they're going to examine you and that kind of stuff. And the same thing applies to our babies. Let them be orphans or let them be injured adults or whatever, is do not feed the animal. Right. And that's the other thing that we, you know, want to emphasize to our callers on the hotline.
Right. Boy, that's a universal thing. People find babies. Oh, we got to feed it. That's the first thing we got to do. Oh. Not warm it up, not make sure it's got fluids, not contact somebody who knows what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Feed them.
Exactly.
And they find interesting things to feed them.
Oh, I know. It's sad.
Yeah. We could do a whole podcast on all the different things.
For sure.
Finders, well-meaning finders have fed youngsters or tried to feed even injured adults.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing with the babies. We, you know, we tell them, we know you have good intentions, but you actually may cause more harm than good.
Yeah. So that's a good thought too. Do you have people that will find baby skunks and then try to raise them?
Not as often as, say, raccoons, right? Like I was saying earlier to you when we were talking, like everybody thinks a baby raccoon is absolutely adorable and they'll keep it for 4 months and then it's going crazy and they're ready to get rid of it. Okay. Well, your baby skunks, they are adorable, but guess what? In 2 weeks, they're ready to spray. So 9 times out of 10, that actually deters people from keeping skunks, baby skunks. Mm-hmm. So that works in their favor and ours, actually.
Sure, sure. Okay. Anything else for what you would talk to? You and I were talking earlier about that the yellow jackets, which is still sticking with me, mm-hmm. and the fact that they can that they are immune to venom, mm-hmm. which is very interesting to me. I mean, do you, what opportunities does the center use to educate the public about skunks? So certainly when finders call you,
yes.
Do you do things on social media? Do you, I know you've been on a couple of podcasts, so that's awesome.
Yeah. So I did some other podcasts here locally. And then, of course we do our public service announcements on social media, our Facebook and Instagram. And then we do have a small educational program that we're trying to grow. And our volunteers are great at sharing this information when we're at exhibits out in the public, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And so for us, it's so important to, not only is our mission about rehabilitation and the conservation of the land, of course, but educating the public. And mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer, if you educate the kids and get them with that knowledge, it will carry with them throughout life. And they'll also educate their family members, their you know, parents, and maybe change their mind with grandparents, that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's about educating as many as possible, because while not every skunk is going to come into our care, right? They may not be local, or they don't want to travel the distance, but if you have that information out there in some fashion or format, then they at least know what to do and how to proceed to get it to the correct rehab or placement for that animal.
Right. Yeah. I've been around a long time, and when everybody, in at least in Minnesota, were trying to get recycling programs going, it was the kids.
Yes.
Kids are the ones, that was the key. And it was the kids teaching the families and everything about doing it. And that's how it got a foothold.
Yeah. And I believe that's going to apply for saving the wildlife as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally agree. And a lot of kids are so oriented toward animals. Whether it's pets or wildlife or whatever. They're closer to nature probably because they haven't had all the influences that adults have had with technology and all the other pressures and things like that that we have that kind of pull us away.
And we definitely want those future wildlife rehabbers or environmental scientists or even wildlife veterinarians. We need them in the future, that's for sure.
Oh, right. Any other ideas or thoughts come to mind about skunk natural history or why they come into care or anything like that?
Well, the thing about skunks, you know, unfortunately, they don't have a long lifespan in the wild. Now, if a healthy skunk is out there and they're not encountering humans, you know, they can live a long life up to 6 years, but normally they're sick or dead in less than 3 years, right?
Wow.
In captivity, they can live up to 10 years of age, but in the wild, they don't have a very long lifespan, which is sad. And so that's the other thing I tell people, is that the skunks are not going to stick around very long, because unfortunately, something's probably going to happen to it. But, you know, for us, it's about getting healthy genes out there for reproduction to occur.
Right.
But natural history wise, I mean, I think we pretty much covered everything that would be applicable to across the board for skunks, really.
So having 2 to 10 kits, they only have one set of kits per year, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And so approximately how many of those kits do survive to reproductive age? Is it half? Is it less than half?
I would probably say less than half. You know, picked off by predation. Now the babies, if they come out of the den without mom because they're starving, like starving mm-hmm. animals will of course leave their den site mm-hmm. to seek, you know, help, let it be, you know, food that they're trying to find on their own or going up to humans. You know, squirrels do that. But you know, the small kids get picked off quicker by predation. Now, the smaller ones would be picked off by, say, your coyotes or even your foxes, something, you know, a little bit larger than mm-hmm. raccoons and stuff like that.
So how many, you've got between 2 and 10 kits that are born, you know, the female has one batch. I don't know if that's what it's called. For bird, it's a clutch, but you know what it is for skunks. Once a year, about how many of these survive to reproductive age? Is it like half? Is it less than half? What do you think?
It's usually less than half. Even if they come in to us and, you know, we've got, say, 5 in our litter, not always do they all make it because of their body condition, you know, their ailment, their injury, and so forth. So even if we get all five of our babies in, it doesn't usually mean that they all make it. So less than half usually is what I would say for a statistical, you know, reasoning for release rate.
Okay. Okay. Well, wow. I certainly learned a lot, and I thought I knew a lot about skunk natural behavior and natural history, but I have certainly learned a whole bunch, which just adds to all of our collective background information for rehabilitation, but also for helping the finders and the general public, because they're certainly a piece, a piece of the story. So thank you for that. That was Ruby Davis, the Wildlife Rehabilitation Director for Carolina Wildlife Conservation Center. There, she oversees the center's rehabilitation, along with the training and mentoring of staff and volunteers. Next episode, part two, we do a deep dive into skunk care and rehabilitation. I learned so much. Ruby generously shares a wealth of experience and know-how, so please join us. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the partnership coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Clocky. Special thanks to our guest Ruby Davis, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.